Angelica, Renee Wilson, and Julie Mosley, who all went missing while Christmas shopping in 1974. The car they were driving was left behind in the mall parking lot. The girls have not been seen since. The eldest of the three was Rachel, who was 17 at the time. Rachel had gotten married about 6 months before. Renee was 14 years old, and Julie was 9. Just before noon, Rachel had driven to Renee's house to pick her up. At the last minute, Renee's neighbor, Julie, asked if she could come too. Her mother said no at first, because Julie had no money to spend, and she didn't know Rachel very well. But Julie didn't want to be alone all day, so her mother eventually agreed. They were planning to be back by 4 p.m, as Renee had a party she was attending with her new boyfriend, who was also the older brother of Julie. When the girls were not back by then, the families became concerned. Renee's father found Rachel's car in the parking lot at about 8 p.m. He and a neighbor stayed there all night waiting. A police report was made around midnight. The next day, on Christmas Eve, Rachel's husband, Tommy, received a letter that appeared to have been written by Rachel. It said, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week. The car is in the Sears upper lot. Love, Rachel." The postmark did not contain a city, only a blurred zip code. Handwriting experts have gotten inconclusive results from analyzing the letter. The families did not believe that it was written by Rachel, or that the girls had run away. They are convinced this was an abduction. Before Rachel married Tommy, Rachel's older sister Deborah was briefly engaged to him. Deborah claims the relationship was not that serious, and there were no hard feelings between her, Tommy, and Rachel. Deborah was 19 years old and lived with Tommy and Rachel. She was invited to accompany Rachel and Renee to the mall that day, but she declined. There were several reported sightings of the girls getting into a vehicle. A man claimed to have seen the girls in the parking lot being forced into a van by a strange man. When confronted, the man yelled at him, saying it was a family dispute and to stay out of it. A store clerk said a woman had told her she saw some men push the girls into a yellow pickup truck. However, the police were never able to locate that woman for more information. Police believe there was more than one person involved. Some have speculated that at least one of the girls may have known the identity of their abductors. It has now been 47 years, and thousands of leads have been followed to no avail. Here are their age-progressed photos. It has been said that the families of Renee and Julie suspect Tommy, Deborah, and Rachel's parents were involved, or know what happened. According to Rachel and Deborah's younger brother, their father had been physically abusive to them during their childhood. He died shortly after the disappearance from stage 4 cancer. Next is the case of Bobby Dunbar. Bobby Dunbar was 4 years old in 1912 when he disappeared while on a fishing trip with his parents in Louisiana. After 8 months of searching, investigators believed they found the child in Mississippi with a man named William Walters. Bobby's parents identified the boy as Bobby. However, both William and a woman named Julia Anderson insisted the boy was in fact her son, Bruce Anderson. Newspaper reports differ on the initial reaction of the boy when he met the Dunbars. One account said he immediately shouted, "Mother," and they hugged, while another reported the child cried, and the Dunbars were not sure if he was their son. Some reports said he showed no recognition towards Bobby's younger brother, Alonzo. The next day, after bathing him, Mrs. Dunbar said she identified his moles and scars and was certain that he was Bobby. Julia Anderson was unmarried and worked as a field hand for William Walters' family. She allowed him to take her son for a few days to visit one of William's relatives. However, this trip turned into a few months. According to newspaper reports, Julia was presented with 5 different boys, including a boy thought to be Bobby Dunbar. Julia asked if it was him, but was not given an answer, and finally declared that she was not sure. Newspapers questioned her moral character in having had 3 children out of wedlock. The other 2 were deceased at that point. She had no money to pursue a court battle, and when home, she later returned to Louisiana for William Walters' kidnapping trial to attest his innocence. William Walters and the boy had spent some time in Poplarville, Mississippi, where the community had gotten to know them well. A number of them reported seeing William with the boy before the disappearance of Bobby Dunbar. Despite their testimonies, the court determined the boy was Bobby Dunbar, and William was convicted of kidnapping. He served 2 years, then was released after a successful appeal. Julia eventually married and had 7 more children. They said her life was a happy one, but she often spoke of her lost son. The boy raised as Bobby Dunbar married and had 4 children of his own. In 1966, he passed away from heart disease at age 57. In 2004, one of his sons, Bob Dunbar Jr., consented to a DNA test. The results showed that he was not a blood relative to his cousin, the son of Bobby Dunbar's brother, Alonzo. This proves the boy they supposedly rescued was not the boy they were looking for, and was likely to be Bruce Anderson. The fate of the real Bobby Dunbar is unknown. It's thought that he may have fallen into the lake during the fishing trip and either drowned or was eaten by an alligator. Next is Great Mulair Mystery. Great Mulair Mystery refers to the disappearance of a pilot, Peter Gibbs, who went missing on Christmas Eve 1975 after he took an unscheduled flight from the Isle of Mull, Scotland. His body was discovered 4 months later on a hillside near the airfield. Peter had been a pilot for the Royal Air Force and served in World War II. He later became a professional musician in the London Symphony Orchestra, but was fired after insulting one of the conductors, who was German. Peter continued to fly regularly and had over 2,000 hours of flight experience. On the morning of the disappearance, Peter and his girlfriend, Felicity, flew from Mull to the Isle of Skye. They flew back to Mull and had dinner at the hotel. After dinner, Peter decided to take a solo flight. He borrowed 2 torches to use as landing lights for Felicity to guide him with. Some guests watched from the hotel as Peter appeared to spend an unusually long time warming up the engine. He turned the plane lights off, then on, then off again, and took off in the pitch darkness. Hotel guests went upstairs to watch the landing, since the airfield was almost never used at night. They saw Felicity stood at the end of the runway, holding the torches. After 10 minutes, the owner of the plane began to worry and went to find it. A huge search was conducted over the Christmas period, but neither Peter or the plane was found. 4 months later, a local shepherd found Peter's body lying on a remote hillside about 1 mile from the airfield, not far from the road. The initial search passed through that area, but nothing was found at the time. He was lying across a fallen tree. The position indicated he was walking downhill. There was no sign of the plane. A post-mortem showed only minor injuries, and there was nothing to suggest he fell from the plane. It was determined the cause of death was exposure, possibly hypothermia. 10 years later, in 1986, a diver reported seeing a small plane 200 meters away from the Isle of Mull. Another plane was sighted under the sea in 2004, but was later determined to belong to the Royal Air Force. It's not certain whether this was the same plane seen by the diver. Theories suggest Peter may have crashed into the ocean, then swam to shore in the freezing water. However, no salt was found on him. The medical examiner suggested that 4 months of rain and snow could have washed away any traces. To get to where he was, he would have had to climb a steep cliff, an unlikely feat for a 55-year-old man. Next is the case of Jim Sullivan. Jim Sullivan was an American singer, songwriter, and guitarist. He released 2 albums before disappearing without a trace at the age of 34. Jim had 2 young children with his wife, Barbara, and they lived in Los Angeles. Jim was not having much success with his music. In 1975, he decided to travel to Nashville, where his sister-in-law was working as a singer. Jim left LA at noon on March 4th, driving alone in his his Volkswagen Beetle. The next morning, a highway patrol officer gave him a warning for his driving. He had been swerving, but passed the sobriety test. It's thought the swerving was caused by tiredness, as he had been driving for 15 hours at that point. Jim checked into the La Mesa Hotel in Santa Rosa, New Mexico. Reports suggest he did not stay there, as the bed was not slept in. It's unclear where he slept that night. The key was left in his room, and staff noticed he had bought a bottle of vodka at the local store. At 3 p.m., Jim called Barbara, telling her that he was all right and would be leaving the next day to continue his journey. When Barbara asked why he was waiting until tomorrow, Jim told her, "You wouldn't believe me if I told you." She asked if there was anything wrong, and he said, "Forget it. Just forget I said anything. I'll call you from Nashville." The following day, he was seen over 20 miles away, near a remote ranch owned by the Ginetti family. Mrs. Ginetti saw him standing by his car and asked if he needed any help. Jim said no and walked away. That was the last time he was seen. The car was towed by police 2 days later as abandoned. The doors were locked and the engine was dead. Inside was Jim's money, papers, guitar, clothes, and a box of his records. Theories include murder, disorientation, or getting lost. There was a local rumor that the Ginettis were part of a Chicago crime family, but there was no evidence for this. Soon after Jim's disappearance, the sheriff retired, and the Ginettis moved to Hawaii. Jim's former manager recalled a late-night conversation they had. They were talking about what they would do if they had to disappear. Jim said that he would walk into the desert and never come back. Jim's friend stated if he had planned to disappear, there is no way he'd leave his guitar. They insisted he was not suicidal. Some theories suggest a drug deal gone wrong, or that he was in a fugue state when he wandered off. Jim's body was never found, perhaps being consumed by coyotes. Sadly, his daughter passed away in 1988, and Barbara in 2016. In 2017, it was discovered that there was no missing persons case filed in Santa Rosa or Guadalupe County. New Mexico State Police reported that Jim was never listed as a missing person there. The next case is Louis LaPrince. Louis LaPrince was a French artist and the inventor of the early video camera, possibly the first person to shoot a moving picture. He is credited as the father of cinematography. However, he was never able to showcase his camera because he mysteriously vanished in 1890 at the age of 49. Louis's assistant described him as a genius and extraordinary man, standing at 6'3", with the most considerate and calm personality. Louis had been preparing for a trip to New York, where he was set to unveil the world's first ever moving pictures captured on film. He would also be joining his wife and children there. Before this journey, he he decided to return to France to visit his brother in Dijon. Then, on September 16th, he took a train to Paris. He was never seen again. The last person to see Louis was his brother Albert, who saw him boarding a train in Dijon station. He did not disembark from the train in Paris, and no luggage or personal belongings were ever found. Louis's son was found shot dead 2 years later in New York. Multiple conspiracy theories emerged about the reason for Louis's disappearance, including a murder set up by Thomas Edison, secret homosexuality, disappearing to start a new life, or a murder by his brother. No evidence exists for any of these. One explanation was that he committed suicide because of his debts. However, others point out the fact he had a screening in New York to reveal his breakthrough makes this theory implausible. His business was going well. He was a family man, and his wife and children strongly defended him, believing he would not disappear on purpose or commit suicide. He had also taken his best cameras with him. By disappearing with his invention, several years of hard work also disappeared, and his family would not be able to profit from his patents for several more years. In 2004, a police archive was found with a photo of an unidentified drowned man with some resemblance to Louis. He was discovered in the Seine River shortly after his disappearance. If this is Louis and he did not commit suicide, it seems to suggest foul play. Perhaps a robbery gone wrong, an accident, or something more sinister. Next is the case of Jean Spangler. Jean Spangler was an American actress who appeared in several 1940s Hollywood films. She gained public attention after her mysterious disappearance in 1949, aged 26. On the evening of October 7th, Jean left her home in Los Angeles for work. She was last seen at a grocery store several blocks from her home. 2 days later, her purse was discovered in a remote area of a park, over 5 miles from her home. Jean had divorced her husband, Dexter, in 1946. They had a daughter together named Christine. After a long court battle, Jean was awarded custody in 1948. She lived in a residential complex with her mother, brother, his wife Sophie, and 5-year-old Christine. Jean left the apartment at 5 p.m. She said she was going to talk to Dexter about a late child support payment. After that, she would go to work on a night shoot for a film in which she was an extra. At 7 p.m., Jean called Sophie to say she would be working an 8-hour shift and would not be home that evening. At the time, Jean's mother was out of town. The following morning, Sophie went to the police and filed a missing person report after Jean had not returned. There were no records indicating she had worked that night. A saleswoman recalled seeing her browsing the shop around 6 p.m. and noted that she appeared to be waiting for someone. This was the last known sighting. The ex-husband, Dexter, was questioned, but claimed he had not seen her for several weeks. Dexter's new wife backed up his story. Jean's purse was found with a strap torn on one side, as if it had been ripped from her arm. Sophie said Jean had not been carrying any money, so it was unlikely to be a robbery. The park was searched by hundreds of volunteers. One volunteer's dog dug up a denim LA County jail uniform from a shallow hole. Nothing else was found. There was a note inside the purse addressed to someone called Kirk. It said, "Kirk, can't wait any longer. Going to see Dr. Scott. It will work best this way while Mother is away." Neither Kirk nor Dr. Scott could be located. When Jean's mother returned, she said someone named Kirk had picked Jean up at her house twice, but had stayed in his car. Police questioned every doctor with the last name Scott in LA, but none of them had a patient under Jean's name. Jean had once been in an abusive relationship with a man she called Scotty, but her lawyer said she had not seen him for 4 years. Jean had recently completed a film starring actor Kirk Douglas. Kirk told police he hardly knew Jean and never saw her outside of the film set. Jean's girlfriend said she was 3 months pregnant and had talked about having an abortion, which at the time was illegal. There were rumors of a medical student known as Doc who performed abortions for money, but police could not locate him or prove that he existed. Jean had told a friend, actor Robert Cummings, that she was having a casual affair at the time, but did not mention the man's name. The next case is Frederick Valentik. Frederick Valentik was a 20-year-old Australian pilot who disappeared while on a training flight in 1978. It was a Saturday evening and Frederick was flying towards King Island. At 7 p.m., he reported to traffic control he was being followed by an aircraft about 1,000 feet above him, and that his engine was running roughly. When asked to identify the aircraft, he replied, "It isn't an aircraft." The transmission was interrupted by unidentified noise, described as metallic scraping sounds, before contact was lost. His plane disappeared and was never found. Before being cut off, Frederick described the aircraft as illuminated by 4 bright landing lights moving at high speeds. It was orbiting above him and had a shiny metal surface with a green light on it. There were several reports of a UFO sighting that night with a similar description. However, the Department of Transport was skeptical that the UFO was responsible. Some officials speculated that he became disoriented and saw his own lights reflected in the water, or lights from a nearby island, while flying upside down. Frederick was studying part-time to become a commercial pilot, but had a poor record. Twice he failed all 5 commercial license exams, and a month before his disappearance, he failed 3 more. One time he strayed into a controlled zone, receiving a warning. Twice he deliberately flew into a cloud and was almost prosecuted. his father, Guido. Frederick was a firm believer in UFOs and had been worried about being attacked by them. A search of 1,000 square miles was conducted. It's thought that he may have planned his own disappearance. The plane had enough fuel to fly 500 miles, but during the flight, his location was never plotted on radar, so he may not have been on the designated route. Melbourne police received reports of a plane making a mysterious landing not far away around this time. His type of plane could not have flown upside down for long without the engine cutting off. If he was flying upside down, like officials believe, it would have to be on purpose, which suggests suicide. Those who knew him said that was not possible. A retired US pilot believed it may have been an accidental crash, where he inadvertently put the plane into what's known as a graveyard spiral. This would account for the malfunctioning engine. An astronomer speculated the lights he saw were the planets Venus, Mars, and Mercury. There has not yet been a definitive explanation of Frederick's disappearance. Sadly, his father passed away in 2000. Next is the case of Greg Freer. Greg Freer was a 17-year-old high schooler from Scotia, New York. On June 27, 2004, Greg was visiting a friend in the area. At around 2 p.m., he was seen walking into the nearby woods. Greg never returned to the apartment complex and left his car behind. He did not have his cell phone on him or his wallet when he disappeared. He said he was heading back home and that he'd be there in about 10 minutes, but never arrived. It's not known why he was walking, since he had driven his car there. Greg's mother reported him missing later that evening. Initially, his case wasn't publicized by his family because they thought Greg may have left on his own and wanted to let him work on whatever was bothering him. On the day he disappeared, they learned that he lost his job at the local supermarket. He had been pretending to work there for 8 weeks after he was fired. Greg had recently lost his driver's license and never obtained a new one. His social security number has not been used since he disappeared, suggesting he has not opened a bank account or applied for a job in the US in the last 18 years. The friend Greg was visiting says he was upset over a recent breakup with his girlfriend, but did not indicate he was planning to run away or harm himself. Greg had argued with his mother over the phone about losing his job, and she asked him to come home, which he agreed. Police tracked 400 leads and conducted hundreds of interviews. Grounds were searched with cadaver dogs in the area he was last seen, and the Mohawk River was searched, but no trace of Greg has been found. Investigators don't believe Greg left on his own or committed suicide. They believe he may have met with foul play. Family say it's uncharacteristic of him to leave without warning. He ran away once in his early teens, but was only gone for one night. He has no history of behavioral problems. Despite this, some have speculated suicide due to the situation of his job, his girlfriend, and the argument with his mother. Greg had just finished his junior year at Scotia Glenville High School and was co-captain of the soccer team. Several colleges were looking to recruit him. In 2021, a new lead was revealed. A co-worker believes he saw Greg in the passenger seat of a vehicle traveling north on Route 50. The sighting was sometime during the 5 days after his disappearance in 2004. Next is Walter Collins. Walter Collins was a 9-year-old Los Angeles boy who went missing in 1928. The disappearance was the subject of the movie Changeling, where Walter's mother, Christine, is portrayed by Angelina Jolie. On March 10th, Christine had given Walter money for him to go to the cinema and was last seen on a street corner around 5 p.m. He never made it to the movie and did not return home. Christine reported him missing 5 days later. In September, a boy claiming to be Walter was found in Illinois. Christine spoke to him on the phone, then paid for him to be brought to LA. Upon meeting him, Christine said the boy was not Walter. Under pressure to resolve the case, Captain Jones convinced her to try the boy out and take him home. She returned 3 weeks later, again saying that it was not her son. Although she had dental records to prove her case, Captain Jones accused her of being a bad mother and bringing ridicule to the police. He had Christine committed to the psychiatric ward under a code 12, a term used to jail or commit someone who was deemed difficult or an inconvenience. Captain Jones then questioned the boy, who admitted he was actually 12-year-old Arthur Hutchins, a runaway from Iowa. Arthur had been picked up by police in Illinois, and when asked if he was Walter Collins, he first said no, but then said yes. His motive was to get to Hollywood so he could meet his favorite actor. Christine was released 10 days later. She won a lawsuit against Captain Jones and was awarded $10,800, which she never paid. The next year, a man named Gordon Northcott was found guilty of abducting, molesting, and killing 3 young boys in what became known as the Wineville Chicken Coop murders. These 3 boys did not include Walter, but Gordon's mother, Sarah, confessed that Walter was another victim. No forensic evidence was found to prove this, and Sarah later tried to rescind her confession. Gordon confessed to a total of 9 murders, but denied killing Walter. Christine chose to believe her son was still alive and continued to search for him for the rest of her life before passing away in 1964. Next is Owen Parfitt. Owen Parfitt was a disabled man that disappeared from his house in 1763. Owen lived with his sister Mary, who was 15 years older than him, and was his caretaker. They lived in a small English town called Shepton Mallet. Owen disappeared once before when he was young and was that included piracy and battles. Most people were skeptical of his tales. By age 65, Owen was crippled and could barely move at all. Mary was 80 and had also become frail, but was determined to care for her brother. She employed a young girl, Susanna, who lived next door to help them. Mary and Susanna would carry Owen to his favorite chair each morning. If the weather was nice, they would sit him outside while Susanna and Mary would clean the house. On one summer day, Owen was sitting outside on the front porch. There were dozens of people working in the fields nearby, and horses and carts were constantly passing by on the main road. Susanna had gone home, and in the afternoon was told that Owen was missing. She went back and found Mary collapsed on the floor, crying uncontrollably. Outside, Susanna found Owen's chair undisturbed, along with his blanket. There was no sign of struggle, and there were no footmarks in the grass. The villagers immediately searched the whole town and countryside. Ponds and wells were all drained. Owen could not stand up, even if he could walk. It was not possible to leave the village so quickly without the search party seeing him. If someone had taken him, there should have been dozens of witnesses, but nobody had seen anything. Owen and Mary were poor, so there would have been nothing of value to steal. Mary was nearly 90 at the time and was completely devastated. She passed away a few years later. 50 years after Owen's disappearance, some gentlemen who had heard about the story came to the town and conducted interviews. The villagers all seemed to love Owen, although it was said he could have a short temper. They came to believe he was taken by demons. One villager said Mary had heard a loud noise, and when she came downstairs, Owen was gone, and the chair was knocked over. Susanna denied it and claimed there was no noise, and the chair was not displaced. Nothing was ever documented about Mary's accounts. One theory says Susanna was involved, or knew what happened, that Owen had an argument with another villager, perhaps a relative of Susanna, who then strangled him. Some believe he may have lied about his injuries and could actually walk. But this does not explain where he would have gone or why he would do that to his elderly sister, who he loved very much. Next is Flight 19. Flight 19 was a group of 5 US military airplanes that disappeared over the Bermuda Triangle on a combat training exercise in 1945. A Navy report concluded the flight leader mistook small islands for the Florida Keys after his compasses stopped working. They then headed in the wrong direction, away from land. All 14 men on the flight were lost. A further 13 crew members who were sent to search for Flight 19 were also lost due to a mid-air explosion. The flight leader was U.S. Navy Lieutenant Charles Taylor, who had 2,500 flying hours, while the trainee pilots each had 300. All aircrafts were fully fueled. However, they were all missing clocks, This was not a concern, since each person was expected to have their own watch. The flight was scheduled for December 5th. Lieutenant Taylor arrived slightly late and they took off after 2 p.m. from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He had asked for the day off but was denied. Weather was described as favorable. Radio conversations were overheard by the airbase. The practice bombing operation was carried out at about 3 p.m. when a pilot requested to drop his last bomb. 40 minutes later, another flight instructor, Lieutenant Robert Cox, was forming his students for the same exercise when he received an unidentified transmission. One of the students, named Powers, was heard saying, "I don't know where we are. We must have gotten lost after that last turn." Lieutenant Cox replied, "Powers, please identify yourself so someone can help you." They didn't respond. Lieutenant Cox tried again and received a reply from Lieutenant Taylor, who said, "Both my compasses are out. I'm overland. I'm sure it's the Keys, but I don't know how far down, and I don't know how to get to Fort Lauderdale." He was asked to switch to a different radio frequency for search and rescue, but replied, "I cannot switch frequencies. I must keep my planes intact." A few minutes later, he told his flight to change course to due east. Someone else in the flight said, "Damn it, if we could just fly west, we would get home." This later led to questions about why the students did not simply head west on their own. It was explained this can be attributed to military discipline. As the weather deteriorated, radio contact became intermittent, and it was believed they were over 230 miles out to sea, east of the Florida Peninsula. At around 6 or 7 p.m., after the sun had set, Lieutenant Taylor was heard saying, "We'll have to ditch unless landfall. When the first plane drops below 10 gallons, we all go down together." To ditch means to perform a water landing. At 7:30 p.m., the search team took off, but was not heard from again. At 9 p.m., flames were seen from an apparent explosion 30 meters high and was burning for 10 minutes. No survivors were located among the wreckage. Extensive searches have been conducted over the decades, but none of the Flight 19 aircrafts were found. Records show that training accidents between 1942 and 45 caused the loss of 95 crew members from Fort Lauderdale. It is said that this particular incident sparked the legend of the Bermuda Triangle. Next is Harold Holt. Harold Holt was elected as 17th Prime Minister of Australia. The following year, he disappeared while swimming in the sea. Harold loved the ocean, and on December 17th, he was spending the weekend at his beach house in Portsea. He drove to Point Nepean, accompanied by 4 friends. On the way back, he suggested they stop at Cheviot Beach for a swim before lunch. He had spearfished there undercurrent he felt made him stay close to the shore. Meanwhile, Harold swam out with almost reckless abandon. He never cried out for help. Instead, he kept swimming into deeper water until he disappeared under the waves, seemingly caught in a riptide. Harold's disappearance triggered a massive search operation. By 1:30 p.m., three divers had entered the water, but found it too rough to continue, and instead a helicopter was used to search the coastline. Other boats, police divers, and diving teams from the Australian Navy had attempted searches, but no trace of Harold was found. The next evening, the government presumed him to be dead. Harold became the third Australian Prime Minister to die while in office. An inquest returned the verdict of accidental drowning. It's generally accepted that Harold overestimated his swimming ability. He was 59 years old, and doctors had advised him to reduce his diving activity. He was taking morphine at the time for a shoulder injury. Theories suggest he was stung by a jellyfish, struck by debris on the water, or suffered a heart attack. Some believe that he committed suicide. Harold's wife later said he was much too selfish to kill himself. She knew of his many affairs and believed this is why he didn't allow security to travel with him outside of work. One of his mistresses, Marjorie, was there when he disappeared. He was also facing pressure from his party, who were threatening to challenge his leadership. A story published in the Sunday Observer alleged that Harold had been murdered as part of a CIA plot to prevent him from taking Australia out of the Vietnam War, but this claim lacked any evidence.